You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. 6 out of the 10 most viewed videos on YouTube are marketed towards kids. Baby Shark sits very comfortably at the number one spot. I'll spare you that soundbite, though. YouTube is full of kids' content that tries to get the attention of children and of the site's algorithm with bright colors and hot buzzwords. And even with the child filters on, it's difficult for YouTube to effectively sift and winnow through millions of videos to decide what's safe and appropriate for kids to watch. It's pretty much impossible for that algorithm to figure out what's truly educational or beneficial. What do parents need to know? We've got a Wisconsin expert on kids media with us, and we'll find out what PBS Wisconsin has to offer, too. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do your kids watch YouTube? How old are they? What rules and restrictions do you have in place to keep them safe? Have you found them watching a lot of annoying video or even something that you found concerning? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Heather Kerkorian is director of the Cognitive Development and Media Lab at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. Heather, thanks a lot for being with us.
Yeah, thank you.
And Jen Kobolecki is associate director of education engagement at PBS Wisconsin. Jen, thanks for coming over to the radio side of Wisconsin Public Media.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Rob.
Heather, let's start with you. Kids, statistics show, I've seen it in my own extended family, they're watching a lot of YouTube. How important is it for us to study what kids are doing with YouTube and what's out there for them?
Yeah, YouTube is definitely the most commonly used media. So video content is the most common media for kids. And within that, YouTube is by far the most commonly used platform for young kids. And the average in the U.S. for kids under 8 is about 2.5 hours per day, based on our most recent estimates. So it's a substantial amount of time for kids.
And anybody who uses YouTube, as I do, know YouTube suggests things for you and sometimes autoplays things for you next. What do we know about the kind of content that kids get, especially younger kids, if they're parked in front of YouTube for more than 20 minutes or so?
Yeah, so part of the algorithm is driven by just what's most popular. So part of what you see is driven by what other people are seeing and clicking on. But it's also based on what you've been clicking on. So depending on whether kids are using a device that's just for them or a shared device that maybe their parents use too, logged into the same account, what they see might partly depend on their parents' or other family members' viewing history as well.
And a lot of your work deals with how kids interact with media. And that's part of the story here, right? Because they might click on the next shiny story. Does that make kids connect more with the YouTube media they're watching, for better or worse?
Yeah, so often what's promoted are things that YouTube and Google think that you're likely to click on and enjoy watching. Whether you actually have positive emotional responses to it or not is a different question, but you'll keep watching, and that's the most important thing for them. So for sure, the things kids are likely to click on are things that Google thinks they're likely to keep watching.
We'll dig more into the content that kids encounter. But Jen, I want to bring you in now. You're with PBS Wisconsin. You work on creating and spreading content that will be helpful and beneficial for kids. Can you talk about, first of all, the kind of content for younger kids that you offer via PBS Wisconsin?
Absolutely. Well, it is a real honor to work with PBS Wisconsin because PBS creates really high quality content. It is back from the days of when Sesame Street was on the air, created with educators in the room before it's ever shot or animated. And we have researchers involved. These are all really, really smart people that are making media that is designed to help children learn. And that is just really a pleasure. So we do that. We share nationally produced media from PBS Kids, and we also make media for some older grades here in Wisconsin.
And you don't just broadcast it. There is a presence for PBS Kids and PBS Wisconsin on YouTube. How do you try to keep a nice, clean channel that that kids and parents can count on?
Well, being wherever kids and families are finding media is a great thing. So I don't have the expertise to speak to the tracking on the different platforms, but we are out there. We want to be able for families and kids to find us. And it's great content. It's free content. It's commercial free content, which I think is also a really important point.
Talking to Jen Kobolecki, Associate Director of Education Engagement at PBS Wisconsin, and Heather Kerkorian with the Cognitive Development and Media Lab at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. We're looking at programs created for kids, what's available on YouTube, options we have on PBS Wisconsin, and what happens when the YouTube algorithm takes over what kids are watching. You can join in as a parent. Do you have an experience with this? Is there a source of kids' media that you have come to trust and count on? Have you had seen some weird stuff pop up on YouTube over time? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. There's some weird stuff on YouTube, maybe uncanny. Here's an example of a pretty popular one video. This is the third most watched video of all time on YouTube.
Johnny.
Yes, Papa.
Eating sugar.
No, Papa.
Telling lies.
Okay, I watched this for the first time. This is a kid eating sugar, hopefully out of a kitchen cabinet. This is the kind of kitchen cabinet where I would think cleaning supplies might end up a lot. It didn't look like something I would have wanted a little kid to watch when I was raising little kids. They're 20 now. They can watch what they want. What is good content for kids, Heather?
Yeah, it's a complicated umbrella of things. But so one of the most common things you'll find on YouTube for kids are music videos like the one you just played that are nursery rhymes or other kind of kid-friendly videos. And also things that we would classify as wish fulfillment. So unboxing videos where they see kids opening toys or eating candy, like the example you just shared. And those kinds of things I think of as kind of the junk food of video. They're not necessarily harmful in moderation, but they're probably not very educationally valuable either. What we would want to see more of for educational value are things that are designed around an educational curriculum. So not just dropping in the occasional mention of letters or numbers or things like that, but really a whole curriculum designed around that educational content.
Now, there was a wave of articles a few years back about worse than that, where online trolls basically would produce videos with popular characters like the Peppa Pigs and things like that and end up with really disturbing and violent imagery. YouTube was at that point trying to crack down. I don't know how they're doing. Do you have a sense of if at least that hazard is less hazardous now?
Yeah, it's definitely gotten better. So back, you know, the videos you're talking about, and at that time, it was completely algorithm driven. It was all automated. So it was pretty easy to trick the algorithm into choosing content that wasn't necessarily for kids or wholesome for kids. Since then, Google's incorporated some human monitors who will both look at content that's been flagged as inappropriate on YouTube Kids, for example, but also do more proactive searching, so explicitly looking for that content. So it's reduced quite a bit.
Jen, you were talking about how content is developed here at PBS Wisconsin and with PBS Kids nationally. And Heather was mentioning, you know, what goes into making quality content. Can you talk a little more about the process, how we figure out how to make stuff that's educational for kids, but not so educational they're going to not want to watch it and watch the shiny nursery rhyme video instead?
Absolutely. I can speak to that. And I want to share too, Rob, that what's really important is not just the media itself and kind of plopping a child down in front of a screen to watch that media, but co-viewing media with your child or educators co-viewing media with their students and really helping them understand and navigate the learning that's embedded. That's really, really key to this process. But yeah, when we make media at PBS Wisconsin and when PBS Kids is making media, they are starting with a learning goal that they're trying to achieve. So I'll give you an example. There's a fairly new program on PBS Kids called Work It Out Wombats. It is a delightful show about a family of wombats that is trying to solve many problems. The learning goal that is embedded in that show is around computational thinking. That may not mean anything to you if you're wondering what that is. You use computational thinking all the time. If you have ever followed a recipe, that is computational thinking. You're doing things in a certain order. If you've ever troubleshot a problem and thought about, well, how do we make a solution to this? Those are computational thinking skills. So PBS Kids is going to have researchers and experts on computational thinking involved in the making of that show and the way that it's animated, even the poses of the characters, having thinking poses, and the scripts, of course, are going to support different aspects of computational thinking. And we are always testing with educators and kids. And that's true for the media we make at PBS Wisconsin Education as well.
And what age range are these wombats working for?
They are working for kids ages 2 through 8.
Excellent. And Heather, I wanted to follow up on that point that Jen made about co-watching, parents watching the media along with the kids, especially maybe when there's something new that they're seeing for the first time. How important is that?
It's really important, especially the younger the kids are, the more they really benefit from co-viewing, and both in terms of increasing the good stuff, like educational outcomes, but also decreasing bad stuff. So if young kids see something they find scary or they see stereotype content, then co-viewing with parents can help minimize the potential harms of that scary or harmful content too.
We're talking to Heather Kerkorian, cognitive development and children's media expert at UW-Madison, and Jen Kobolecki, PBS educational outreach specialist, PBS Wisconsin, I should say, educational outreach specialist. Talk about the often wild world of children's content on YouTube, how it compares to what's out there on TV, on public TV, and what parents need to know about their kids' media consumption. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you remember watching as a kid on TV, on YouTube, if you're young enough for that to have been out when you were a kid? Do you think it was beneficial for you? Do you feel like it rotted your brain a little bit? And if you're a parent yourself of young kids or have been recently, what was your policy on what they watched, how they watched, when they watched it? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time.
This week on Beta, television and film critic Matt Zoller Seitz talks about David Milch's brilliant reinvention of the Western, Deadwood.
And I think as the show went on, I think it was always good right out of the gate, but the more female characters they added, the richer that part of the show became.
Saturdays at 11 and Sundays at 8 on the Ideas Network.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our conversation about children's media on YouTube, how to know what's safe, what's educational. Our guests are Heather Kerkorian, media and cognitive development expert at UW-Madison, and Jen Kobolecki, associate director of education engagement at PBS Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen kids' content on YouTube that you think is good, that's benefited your child, or bad, less good, disturbing, or just annoying? Is there someplace you go to for something to watch, for your kids to watch, maybe to watch with your kids or your students? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Rachel is with us in Eau Claire. Rachel, hi. Let's try that again. Rachel, are you there? There we go.
I am.
Yeah, what did you want to bring up, Rachel?
Yeah, so I am a Gen Z baby. I grew up watching early generations of YouTube. It was unfiltered. Things like Smosh came up where they have a line where it's, what the expletive? And I'm glad that now generations are having YouTube Kids, especially myself as an educator, where kids are utilizing Blippi and other educational YouTube videos where it's censored for them, where they're not being introduced to harmful content for their brains, when they're being exposed to things that aren't necessarily age-appropriate or ready for them to be exposed to yet.
And Rachel, can I ask, what age do you teach? What grade do you teach?
I'll be teaching middle school, but I've often interacted with kids below the age of 6.
All right. Thanks a lot for sharing that, Rachel. And Jen, can you talk about your outreach to teachers just like Rachel?
Absolutely. Rachel, thanks for caring about these things and the work that you do to inspire young children. Like we were sharing before, Rob, what's really important is the adults that are co-viewing with their children. And so a lot of what we do to support educators in the early childhood space is to share how we can be effective media mentors and really have meaningful media integration. So kids love those characters that they see. They love the stories. And we can use that love and excitement as an entryway to more and deeper learning. So one of the things we do is we have a cohort of librarians from around the state over the past 3 years that have done training programs with our team that help them implement PBS Kids programming into their communities. And that looks like everything from doing story times to doing a farmer's market to having a PBS Kids corner. We have one librarian based in Sheboygan who has done amazing work. And she shared that the media clips that she shows have actually extended into conversations that happen in the home between the parent or caregiver and their child. And what we know is that when the adults in kids' lives are engaged, their learning is just so much more involved and effective. So that's those are the success stories we want to see. We do lots of other professional development around the state. We'll be doing some conferences in person around the state, and we have virtual trainings. Folks can go to pbswisconsineducation.org to check those out.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Heather, I know, I think you've worked on a media literacy issues with kids. And I think of that as like kind of a complicated thing that maybe starts in high school. Am I wrong? Can we start inculcating media literacy at younger ages?
Yeah, we certainly can. And it can be very basic, even at the very early ages, just preschool age kids, even just focusing on, for example, commercial content versus program content. So what's the difference between an ad and what's the purpose of an ad versus the program they're actually watching? And sometimes the lines between those things are very blurred.
Let's go back to our callers now. Scott is with us in Wausau. Scott, hi.
Hi. Yeah, animated shorts are quite a good resource for kids. They're, you know, condensed 5-7 minutes. Usually don't have English, so you're gonna have to pay attention, and usually a good story. Doesn't turn dark very often.
Do you have specific titles that you go for your kids? And I think I heard one of them in the background there, Scott.
Yeah. The titles are just so varied. I mean, I think one of the channels is called CG Bros, but there's thousands of them. There's thousands of animated shorts.
Scott, thanks a lot for the call. Heather, for parents looking for something short like that, there's a lot out there, a massive variation in quality. What would you suggest people seek out?
The best recommendations for YouTube is to make sure you're using YouTube Kids, which is a subset of YouTube. It's not the YouTube main that we would just land on if we search for YouTube. And that does a lot of the filtering for you to get rid of the potentially harmful stuff, the vast majority of it. Within that, and I'm not just saying this because I'm with a bunch of public media folks right now, I promise, but my number one recommendation for parents is PBS Kids content, because it's some of the best content out there and it's freely available.
And for someone like Scott, Jen, who's looking for, say, animated bits in that 5 to, say, 10 minute range, do you have stuff out there?
We absolutely do. And you can find those on pbswisconsin.org. We have our streaming there. We have lots of resources for parents to check out. You can turn on your television and see them there. You can go to YouTube Kids and find them. We also have lots of interactive. So there are games that families can play with their kids for a tablet. And just wonderful, wonderful resources. Those are all available on pbswisconsin.org.
Scott, thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Heather, do we have numbers, time limits where we say, you know, whatever, however good the video content is, this is too much for a kid of age X?
Yeah. So the American Academy of Pediatrics has guidelines for that. And it's age based. So they say for kids 18 months and younger, they recommend minimizing screen time to the extent possible, except for things like video chat, things that are socially interactive. For preschool age kids, kind of that 2 to 5 year old range, they recommend no more than an hour per day. My recommendation to parents is to think a lot more about what they do want their kids to do in the day. Make sure they're getting enough sleep. Make sure they're playing outside every day. Make sure they're having undistracted, screen free social interaction time, like at the dinner table. Once you cover those bases, I don't set a hard limit on screen time over that.
And Jen, if I have this right, a lot of the material from PBS Kids and PBS Wisconsin isn't just the video product. There's support materials in many cases, so that there's something attached to it that isn't just watching the show.
Absolutely. And that's where a lot of our educator training comes in. We also have a huge catalog of self-paced on-demand learning that early childhood educators can access for free. For childcare providers especially, they can earn credit in a system called the Wisconsin Registry, where they track their professional development. And all of this is free. It's a way to learn how to use that media effectively with children and to help learn about media literacy and be a great media mentor for young children.
Heather, I wanted to talk about some of your research here. Now, as grown-ups, we take for granted. We can look at a screen and our brains interpret this two-dimensional surface into a three-dimensional story, and, you know, the narrative stitches together. Our brains aren't necessarily born understanding that. What do we know about how, you know, those younger, you know, infants and toddlers are dealing with this weird 2D window in their universe.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. It violates a lot of the things we might expect based on our experience with the real world. The research shows that until about 2 years old, young kids really don't understand what screens are and what they represent. So they need a lot of help to make sense of it. Starting around 2 years old, kids start to understand really simple video content. But then there's a developmental trajectory there, and it's not until about 12 years of age that kids can understand, for example, a full-length Disney movie the way adults would.
Time for one more caller. David is with us in Rhinelander. David, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, it's not necessarily YouTube, but obviously, you know, there's streaming platforms out there, a bunch of them that are similar to YouTube. And my kids, one of his favorite shows is, and it's actually on Prime Video, is Blaze and the Monster Machines. He loves that show, and I really like it because it brings up a lot of concepts of physics and the science in general. Like in one episode, they talk about like tension on ropes as part of the show, or speed and aerodynamics, all kinds of things like that. And I just like that he can pick that stuff up from that show.
Interesting. Thanks a lot for the recommendation. Streaming a whole other part of the story. Jen, a science-related program where people can learn. These are big trucks, it looks like. Anything at in the PBS Kids world that you'd point toward for kids to learn some of those science principles?
Oh, there is so much there on that topic. Ready, Jet, Go is a program that has tons of great clips for kids to learn about the engineering design process, which is when you try to think of how I might build something, figure out where it doesn't work, revise, and then try again. There is also a great program called Eleanor Wonders Why, which is focused on science inquiry and how we can encourage our kids to be curious as they explore the natural world, as well as thinking about how they access informational texts to get answers to questions they may have about what they find out there.
David, thanks a lot for the call, and we'll leave it there. Thanks, Jen, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Heather, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Rob.
I've been talking to Heather Kerkorian, director of the Cognitive Development and Media Lab at the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, and Jen Kobolecki, associate director of education engagement at PBS Wisconsin. We talked to them about children's content on YouTube and what adults need to know before letting their kids watch, and some good alternatives, including from PBS Wisconsin and PBS Kids. The Barbie movie is setting box office records for Warner Brothers with the highest grossing opening weekend of 2023. The film takes place in the imaginary world of Barbie Land, where a wide range of live-action Barbie and Ken dolls live, including this version, played by actress Kate McKinnon.
Hello! Humans, we're fine. Come into my weird house. Hi, I'm Weird Barbie. I am in the splits. I have a funky haircut and I smell like basement.
Oh my God, I had a weird Barbie.
Yeah, you did.
You make them weird by playing too hard.
It's cool.
Weird or not, Barbie has a long history in American culture as a beloved childhood toy and as a controversial image of American womanhood. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen the Barbie movie yet? What did you think? Even if you didn't, what do you think about Barbie as a piece of American culture? Did you grow up with Barbie? What do you remember? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Christine Whelan is a clinical professor of consumer science in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She's the author of several books on happiness and finding purpose in life, and she's the director of the Money, Relationships, and Equality Initiative. Christine, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
I understand you've seen the movie already. What did you think? Spoiler free.
Spoiler free, I can tell you it's wonderful. Even though it's about Barbies, it's not a kids' movie. Certainly appropriate for parents to bring their kids to the movies, but the parents are really going to get a lot more of the jokes and the cultural implications that the movie is trying to raise.
Barbie has been celebrated in some ways over the decades, criticized, and we'll get into that over the decades as well. How did the movie work with that?
So Barbie is kind of a litmus test for all of us. You either love her or you hate her. And what was great about the movie was that it sort of took it head on. And it sort of went at all of the sort of stereotype ideas. In fact, we have stereotypical Barbie as the star of the movie, but then you've got weird Barbie. You've got every different type of Barbie represented, from the astronaut Barbie to the president Barbie. You have Barbies of all different shapes and sizes in this Barbie world. So the movie really is a wonderful kind of piece of consumerism for Mattel. It's one big advertisement in many ways. And yet it pokes fun at the whole Barbie brand. Is it a feminist movie? Is it a girly movie? Well, that's up to the people who are watching, much like it has always been up to the people who are playing with the dolls or interpreting the dolls in the media.
And that has always been there, as you say. I mean, we've got praise for Barbie for representing an independent woman at various stages who goes off in these careers at the time not always associated with the ones girls would go into. On the other hand, criticized as kind of a backward image of women, and especially a potentially disturbing image when it comes to female body image. Can you talk about the back and forth over Barbie since the doll was created?
So Barbie was born in Willows, Wisconsin, according to Mattel. And with that kind of birth and origin story, the idea is that Barbie is every woman, that Barbie can come from Willows, Wisconsin, and then go on to have her Malibu beach house, and so can you. So there is an element of empowerment for women from the get-go. The Malibu beach house is owned by Barbie, not Barbie and Ken. It is Barbie's house. The idea that Barbie can wear all these different clothes and have all these different images. So that certainly is one of empowerment. At the same time, Barbie's bust to waist measurements are such that she would not be able to exist in the normal human world. She would quite literally topple over. Her neck is too long, her waist is too small, and her bust is too big. And yet, she also has this really notable feature, which is that she has these very arched feet, and she can't stand on her own 2 feet. So one of the major criticisms is, you know, how can this empowered woman really be empowered if she can't literally stand on her own 2 feet? But one of the things I've always thought about with Barbie is that that actually is not a design flaw, nor is it done only for fashion. I think that really is a way of having the girls and potentially boys who are playing with Barbie be part of the story and be co-creators of what Barbie does, because Barbie needs the humans to play with her so that she can be whatever it is that they want her to be as well.
Let's talk a little bit about why we talk about Barbie. I think if you said to somebody on the street, name a doll, there's a good chance Barbie would be among the first they'd name. How big a part of American culture is Barbie?
Barbie came out in 1959 and has been an absolutely huge part of American culture, in part because the price point is reasonable for most American families to afford, and in part because of the size of the doll, very portable, lots of accessories. And then I have to say, a lot of the criticism around it really brought Barbie into sort of the academic forefront. We love to hate Barbie. And so as she became a feminist lightning rod, then she got more press. So Mattel has continued to produce Barbie, more and more different types of Barbie. And that really has followed our consumer culture and our ideas of social norms. So for example, you know, you have different body sizes of Barbie coming out. About 10 or so years ago, you had curvy Barbie come out. And while that was an attempt at more body positivity with Barbie, it turns out that curvy Barbie is only a woman's size 6, which is not exactly inclusive of what most of us would call curvy. And yet there is this idea that as the culture changes, Barbie wants to grow with it.
Talking to Christine Whelan from the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, looking at Barbie. The new movie, pretty big hit right now, a big history in American culture for Barbie spanning the decades. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the doll, the movie, the conversations about the doll and the movie. Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Yordis is with us in Colfax. Yordis, hi.
Hi. I had a lot of Barbies. My sister and I used to play with them, and we liked the Skippers, which was Barbie's sister, I believe. She had a different shape. She didn't have that big chest and a teeny waist. And we, as kids, we really disliked the Barbies for that shape. It was offensive to us, even as children. It's kind of funny. I've talked to my sister about it, and we've laughed about it. And so I sort of became the skipper, and I named it Buffy St. Marie, and my sister became another skipper, and she was Dodie, a genius. And and the Barbies were sort of ancillary people that we just made all these stories around, and then we had an Allen doll that we didn't like, and we called him Ken. We called him Alan Winters, and we made him kind of a jerk. And and it was so, I don't know why, but it wasn't like, I guess the Barbies didn't look like our mom or our older sisters, or it just seemed like sort of uncomfortable for us, even as children. It's just something that I remember.
Really interesting, Yordis. Thanks a lot for sharing that. And Christine, I think this speaks to a big point here. You could put whatever doll in a kid's hands you want. They're going to start creating something different with it. You don't know with it. You don't necessarily know what it's going to be.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is why a lot of therapists still use Barbies and Skippers and other dolls in therapy, because as we watch kids play, we're watching their creative process. We're watching kids work out various ideas. And so with Barbie, some of the concerns are that, you know, if this is the ideal woman image, then are we in fact setting a sort of subtle standard of a very sort of heteronormative, affluent, white standard of beauty that is not attainable for a lot of people, that might not even be healthy for a lot of people. And so there's, you know, whenever you have a doll that is an image of a human in a form that somebody could sort of aspire to, it's going to be a lightning rod, but also you're going to have women and girls who say, no, my mom doesn't look like this. This is weird. I, in fact, want to be this other kind of doll. And that is a really important cultural choice as well. And that sort of speaks to a child's evolution of sort of prioritizing her family and her family's norms over some external societal norms. So yeah, these dolls play an outsized role.
Yordis, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Christine Whelan from the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology, looking at Barbie, the Barbie movie, and the role of the doll in American popular culture. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you grow up with Barbie? Did you reconceive the Barbie extended universe in your own way? How did you play with Barbie and friends? Do you have Barbie dolls for your own kids now? What are they doing with them? Have you checked out the movie? Are you planning to? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about Barbie with Christine Whelan, clinical professor of consumer science in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. We're checking out the success of the Barbie movie and the role of Barbie in popular culture. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this part of your childhood, your child's childhood? Have you seen the movie? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Elizabeth is with us in Madison. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi there. I played with Barbies. I'm almost 65. And I remember playing with Barbies where we could change the hairstyles of the Barbies by popping the heads off. So you could prop different heads on the Barbie. So that was kind of unique back then. And then as I grew older and obtained my teacher of the deaf and hard of hearing degree, I got a Barbie who was African-American Barbie, who was a teacher of the deaf and hard of hearing. And she even had a chalkboard or a kind of a board with different sign language signs on it. So just thought I'd let you know.
That. And you used that Barbie as part of your instruction, Elizabeth, is that right?
I did. The kids loved that Barbie. Yeah, because, you know, they could relate to her because she did a I love you sign with one of her hands, the specific sign that you see all over the place now. Yeah, so that was kind of fun. And then, of course, it was fun back in the day, popping the heads off the Barbies and putting on different different hairstyles.
Elizabeth, basically. Thank you so much. Two very different uses. Christine, what do you think?
So one of the sort of criticisms I always had over the years of all of the different outfits that Barbie wore was that I, as a child, remember playing with Barbie, and we would take the outfits off of her and pop her heads off and do all sorts of things. And, you know, we take her in the bathtub and cut her hair or put makeup on her. And that in the movie is Kate McKinnon's character of Weird Barbie, because this really was a thing, and is, I'm sure, today, that kids do with dolls. It's this sort of exploration, things that we can't do to ourselves and we can't do in our real life, we experiment on with the dolls. So the idea of popping heads off Barbies is something that I think a lot of us will sort of laugh about as part of our Barbie childhood. And then the other part is, you know, this idea of, am I represented in the Barbie that I see? And we've seen this with many different other kinds of dolls, from Cabbage Patch Kid dolls to the American Girl dolls. The idea of being represented is really important for kids, especially if they have differing abilities, if they have a particular way that they identify. So what we've seen in the Barbie world is more and more of these Barbies trying to make sure that every child sees themselves in Barbie. And that certainly came through loud and clear in the Barbie movie. Now, the thing that we cannot forget amidst all of this is that this is a consumer product. This is a thing. Barbie is a toy. And so the popularity of Barbie is this really interesting mix of consumerism and potentially a sort of optimism, individualism, hope for the future. But at core, we're really talking about getting parents to buy toys for their kids.
Thanks for that call. Jane is with us now on the road headed toward Madison. Jane, hi.
Hi. The one thing that I've noticed is the difference in Barbie over the years is back in the early 60s when I got a Barbie, you collected clothes for her and you created a world for her. And you maybe collected her friends and your mother would make clothes for her and all that. And then all of a sudden, Mattel got into selling a gazillion different Barbies. You went at Winter Wonderland Barbie and this Barbie, and it was more a collector thing, not a use your imagination and play with the doll. Now you had 30 or 40 different ones.
Jane, I got you. Your connection is not awesome, but Christine, I think Jane's backing up your point about this is a consumer product with the goal of getting us to buy more of the stuff, whether it's the clothes and accessories or different incarnations of Barbie.
Indeed it is. And when Mattel launched Curvy Barbie, they had a little bit of a problem because original Barbie's clothes did not fit on Curvy Barbie. And that made Curvy Barbie sort of a less attractive purchase for some families because they'd have to buy a whole new set of clothes for that doll. So the so certainly the idea of collecting Barbies is important. Then there's also the idea of all the accoutrements that go along with Barbie. So the dream house and the convertible and all of the things that go with Barbie. However, I can tell you, at least from my own children's experience, that when they play with Barbie, they also play with Barbie with that Amazon box that they've decorated themselves and turn into a particular Barbie land. So yes, there's more consumerism around it, but that is one of the benefits of dolls. There is still a whole lot of creativity in the play that children engage in with dolls.
Thanks for that call, Jane. We're talking to Christine Whelan from the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology about Barbie, the doll, the movie, the legend, the big part of American popular culture. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Jennifer is with us now in Madison. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. I can't argue with all the complaints that people have made against Barbie. You know, she's not this enough, she's not that enough, whatever. But for somebody my age, when Barbie came out and we were little girls, it was a life changer. Up until that point, you only could play with baby dolls. You could only imagine being a mom, and that was it. That was your life. Barbie allowed little girls to think about being independent, professional, having their own place to live, all of those great things. She was a fantastic role model for girls in that era, in the 50s and early 60s. I don't think she gets enough credit for that.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for the call. And I think this comes up in the movie, Christine.
It absolutely does. And Jennifer, thank you so much for that comment, because really, in our through our present lens, we often don't see that sort of wide swath of history here with Barbie and what a and what a sort of norm shatterer she really was in her time. What I loved about the Barbie movie was that it really now then tries to shatter a new norm, which is that a woman then has to be an astronaut or a doctor or president to be considered a full and successful woman. And what the message of the Barbie movie was, it's enough to just be yourself. And then we also have the message of, you know, have we then marginalized men in terms of our discussion about all the wonderful things that women can do? And then there's just Ken. And so this is what I really liked about the movie, was that I think it kind of pulls to some of those points that Jennifer was making about what Barbie was originally, was somebody who was trying to shatter conventional wisdom. And perhaps with this movie, there is some similar issues being raised, but ones that are really relevant in 2023.
Thanks a lot for that call. Becky joins us next in Hudson. Becky, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to make the comment. I grew up in the 70s playing with Barbies. Barbie was awesome. And yeah, we sort of poo-pooed her body type and everything, but I just feel like if Barbie in this movie is getting us to talk about what women are capable of and how women are marginalized, then Barbie's an awesome thing. When I first heard of the movie, I thought, no way, I'm not going to go see that. But the more I hear about it, the more I think, absolutely, that sounds like fun.
Becky, thanks for the call. Christine, the role of Barbie as a conversation starter.
I went into Von Maur yesterday to go shopping for my kids, and there was a whole Barbie section, not just with Barbie dolls, but with all of the women's clothing in that Barbie pink. And this is the thing about the Barbie brand, is we know that color pink. We know what that means. And I think it's kind of a really wonderful, extravagant, fun, and really kind of joyful expression of femininity in a powerful, but also a sort of way that doesn't take itself too seriously. The other piece that I really enjoyed about the movie was it wasn't just about girl power. It was about people power and not marginalizing any group. And so that really came through loud and clear. And if Barbie can be that for the next generation, well, that would be very interesting.
Thanks for that call. And in just our last minute, Christine, I don't think Barbie ever went away, but do you think this movie is going to herald a big comeback, a resurgence of Barbie for that next generation?
Mattel certainly hopes so, because this was a very long infomercial for the future of Barbie. But we shall see. But Barbie is certainly not hurting in terms of its sales right now. And as we move forward, if anything that we can do right now to help children engage their imaginations, play, get off screens, and create their own worlds, if Barbie can be part of that, I'm all for it.
Christine, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on, as always.
That's Christine Whelan, clinical professor of consumer science in the UW-Madison School of Human Ecology. She's the author of several books on happiness and finding purpose in life. And she's the director of the Money, Relationships, and Equality Initiative. She was with us today to talk about how we look at Barbie dolls in popular culture after the box office success ongoing of the new Barbie movie.